Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the massive uprising in Egypt has been covered as a story of violent clashes in the streets and an awakening on the so-called Arab street. As we record this program, some pro-Mubarak forces are attacking journalists. Plenty of U.S. coverage focuses on the U.S. foreign policy position, with plenty of euphemisms about a tightrope and a delicate balance for a U.S. government that has propped up the Egyptian dictator Hosni Mubarak for three decades. We'll talk about that with Adil Shamu. Also on Counterspin today, it's an obsession for Fox News Channel and an area of concern for other media outlets as well. What would happen if the Muslim Brotherhood rose to power in Egypt? Readers and viewers are told the group gave birth to Al-Qaeda and could very well run Egypt just like Hamas runs the Gaza Strip. But these suggestions seem to badly misread the group's current political stance. We'll sort fact from fiction about the Muslim Brotherhood with Professor Fawaz Gerges. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
There are plenty of things to criticize about U.S. media coverage of Egypt, the reliance on U.S. politicians as experts, or the cliches about the delicate diplomatic dance inherent in supporting a dictator. But some moments stand out for being unusually direct. Take NBC correspondent Richard Engel's report on January 28th, showing that tear gas containers being fired on pro-democracy forces, quote, say clearly in English, made in the USA, close quote. That simple act of reporting cut against the grain of much of what we were hearing in the corporate media. But Engel's very next words seemed to back away from the facts about the dictator's U.S.-supplied weapons.
Egyptians have been picking them up, they've been looking them over, and from an Egyptian perspective, it does seem like Mubarak and the United States are working together. So the U.S. is walking a fine line here.
That Mubarak and the United States have been working together is not an Egyptian perspective, it's a fact. But you can understand Engel's predicament. If he stated the obvious, that U.S.-supplied weapons help Mubarak keep his boot on the opposition's neck, it would make his conclusion that the Obama administration is walking a fine line between the two sides awkward.
As nationalists, U.S. conservatives like to obsess on American exceptionalism, the notion that the U.S. is uniquely accomplished, inventive, beneficent, you name it. This obsession with American superiority seems to increase in inverse relationship to America's apparent declining power and influence in the world. For some reason, these conservatives are adamant that Barack Obama does not believe that the United States is exceptional, since they say he doesn't say so. Take the Washington Post's Kathleen Parker. In a January 30th column about the State of the Union speech, Parker observed that Obama seems afraid to use the term exceptionalism. Admitting that Obama did indeed speak of America's uniqueness, she still held out that he'd, quote, studiously avoided using the word, close quote, meaning exceptionalism. It's passing strange to spend an entire column complaining that an official failed to use a certain word, particularly when the official expressed a very similar sentiment in other terms. And he actually used the very word exceptional in the very appearance conservatives most often cite as evidence that he doesn't believe in it. Yes, it's all a little odd, but odder still, as USNews.com has noted, according to a review of presidential papers going back to 1929, Obama is the only president to have ever uttered the phrase American exceptionalism. Is it something about Obama that compels Parker to demand a higher level of nationalism from him? Given that this is the same Kathleen Parker who once wrote about how Obama lacked a certain American, quote, full-bloodedness, close quote, it seems pretty clear that she's still got some hang-ups about him. And it has nothing to do with the words she thinks he's not using.
Stop me if this sounds familiar. Right-wing activist goes undercover, alleging to be a pimp in an attempt to discredit a group with a different ideology. In 2009, it was Acorn, and now Planned Parenthood is facing a similar attack from activists aligned with an anti-choice group. The story here, if there is one, is that various attempts to get Planned Parenthood staffers to give advice on how to get medical care for underage sex workers didn't work. The staffers called the authorities. But a visit to one office, according to the released video, shows an office manager giving the supposed pimp a few pointers about his supposed child sex ring. And just like with Acorn, the media has swooped in. The New York Times and Washington Post both covered the tape's release on February 2nd. As the Post put it, the video, quote, depicts two hired actors posing as a pimp and a prostitute seeking services at a New Jersey clinic in an operation resembling one that helped take down a liberal anti-poverty group 2 years ago, close quote. Well, that is a reminder that the press never learned the lesson of the Acorn hoax. The supposed pimp did not represent himself that way in his visits, but then cut footage of himself walking around in a garish pimp costume. Did something similar happen here? Well, no one knows for sure, but what is certain is that the sting was almost entirely a bust. But the corporate media apparently didn't see it that way, eagerly acting as a megaphone for the exploits of a few right-wing activists. You'd think they would have learned something from the Acorn episode. Then again, learning a lesson doesn't seem to be the point.
Media accounts often speak of big business and big labor in one breath, giving the impression that the two are equally powerful. That's not so, of course, and nowhere less than on the question of who gets a bigger media megaphone. Take the negotiations between the NFL and the league's Players Association. The current labor deal is about to run out, and the two sides are far apart over issues like profit sharing, so much so that players and the union are expecting a lockout from owners. The Players Association made an ad to rouse public opposition to a lockout with a theme of "let them play," but CBS refused to air it. A network spokesperson told AP that the rejection didn't reflect bias because they wouldn't air an ad from the owner's side either. Of course, CBS is one of the networks that pay the owner's side some $4 billion a year for TV rights. But the Players Union notes that the relationship means even more than you might think. A representative told the January 31st Washington Post that providing the league with guaranteed payment, even when no games are played, the TV deals amount to a kind of lockout insurance that would let the NFL conduct a stoppage without grave financial consequences. That's a critical interference in the supposed balance of power between labor and management. Whatever you think about it, it's an interesting story, one that viewers deserve to hear all sides of, especially sports fans, especially on the outlets that air the games.
And finally, some have started to notice that outlets like Al Jazeera and Al Jazeera English were providing more substantive live coverage of events in Egypt. As one Salon.com writer put it, at one point Fox News was interviewing former Bush diplomat John Bolton, while the supposedly liberal MSNBC had former military spokesperson Dan Senor. Of course, most U.S. viewers can't watch Al Jazeera English since cable companies won't air it. They will give you Fox News, though, and make you pay for it. The difference between the journalistic approaches of these outlets was accidentally illustrated by Martin Indyk in an interview with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow.
Let me ask you about one tactical question in this diplomatic dance, I guess. Are American officials making appearances on Arabic language TV channels at this point? Should they be prioritizing doing that right now?
Probably. I don't think they are doing a lot of that at the moment, partly because the Arab interviewers are likely to be a lot more pressing than polite people like you.
I'll take that as a grave insult. Thank you.
No, it was meant as a compliment.
Well, maybe that's one reason you see so many U.S. officials on U.S. television.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show. The story of the uprising in Egypt has spawned several different themes in the corporate media. Pro-democracy street protests seemed to be viewed with some trepidation at first, as the White House delivered somewhat muddled signals about official Washington's view. Then came violent crackdowns from pro-Mubarak forces in the streets. There were many reports that international journalists were being targeted. And throughout, journalists and pundits have grappled with or danced around the historical legacy of U.S. support for the Mubarak dictatorship. But confronting that fact would put the current story in a different light, and not one flattering to U.S. interests. Joining us now is Adil Shamu. He is a senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus and a professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He recently wrote a piece titled on the wrong side of history in the Middle East. Adil Shamu, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think of coverage that portrayed the U.S. in the early days of the uprising as performing a balancing act or walking a tightrope? Did that accurately reflect the U.S.'s role in the days leading, in the years leading up to this?
Well, for decades, United States have supported this dictator, Hosni Mubarak, in all his policies towards his own people. And we have all the time said that our strategic interest in oil and Israel and other friendly government in Middle East are the reasons we do it and we have to do it. And in the current media, the mainstream media, they all the time equate strategic alliance with as a valued ally with the freedom and democracy and imprisonment of the Egyptian people. And that comparison is false. We should not be call it a balancing act. We should not call it a tightrope. We should not call it a dilemma. What we should do is simply change our policies from those who support such dictators, such devils, basically, and start supporting the people of Egypt and the Arab world in general, because most of them, or all of them practically, are governed by corrupt regime. We supported, we enhanced, we trained and armed their security services to suppress their people.
I wanted to, this is somewhat of an aside, but I was listening to public radio this morning, and on the show called The Takeaway, it's a national show, James Risen, the New York Times reporter, was on, and he reminded listeners that the practice of extraordinary rendition or torture by proxy did not stop with the Bush administration, that the Obama administration continues that. And that, I mean, when I was hearing that, it just made me think doubly so that this idea that the United States can claim to have some sort of even-handedness going into the Egyptian question is sort of ludicrous.
If you just do rendition, that doesn't clean your hand from the crime committed to that person, because you know full well, the U.S. foreign policy knows full well, those countries practice torture and rapes on occasions. So you don't wash your hand and you don't wash moral responsibility by simply taking someone somewhere else. This is like taking someone, have someone else beat them up while you're watching. And many times we actually watch what happened.
In a few minutes, we're going to have Fawaz Jirjis on talking about the Muslim Brotherhood, but I wanted to ask you your opinion about that, too. You have both Hosni Mubarak and many U.S. media people and elites trying to scare people about the prospect of a Muslim Brotherhood takeover, of a co-opting of the movement, of a situation like Iran in 1979. I wanted to ask you, though, let's say that there was no Muslim Brotherhood in the picture. Don't U.S. elites have something to fear just from democracy in general there? I mean, the agreements that Egypt has with Israel, the strategic meaning of Egypt would change even if Egyptians had democracy without the Muslim Brotherhood in the picture.
Yeah, that's very accurate. Just having free elections will balance the Egyptian foreign policy towards the West and Israel. That doesn't mean they will become hostile, but what they'll do, they'll force a change in these countries towards Egypt. And the whole Muslim Brotherhood is really boogeyman, is a myth. Hosni Mubarak used it as a stick over our head all the time. Do you want me or do you want Islamists? The Muslim Brotherhood, for 30 years, they have renounced violence and they have stuck to it very firmly. And moreover, there is no comparison between them and the Islamists in Iran. It's really very unfair and very unjust, and it's trying to scare the American people. And that's how, unfortunately, the right wing all the time try to scare the American people into a political position in our foreign policy or domestically.
And this isn't just about Egypt either. Isn't this story about scaring people about democracy in Egypt? Isn't this part of a larger narrative where the Arab street is portrayed as this sort of dangerous, foreboding thing? It's a sort of Orientalism, if you will.
Well, it's this the Arab world as a whole is really the same as Egypt and Tunisia. They're run by devils. They're run by dictators who are corrupt, who practice maintaining their population in abject poverty and imprison them, and no freedom and democracy. And then we are afraid that the Arab people, 350 million of them, or the Muslims, which is a 1.7 billion, they're going to change. Well, the way I look at it, we should welcome that change. We may not get all of them friendly to us, but sure, we will seed, we will plant the seed for future relationship on equal basis. And that is really what our humanity demands from us. We must accept our own values when we conducted our own revolution against the British.
We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you one more question. In the post-9/11 period, there were many magazine articles that asked why they hate us, meaning why Arabs or Muslims, people in the Muslim world or Arab world, hate the United States. Many big media people suggested that the reason was that they didn't like our freedoms or our modernity.
Yeah.
Does what is happening in Egypt and Tunisia these days put that whole query in a different light?
I think it clarifies that they don't hate us. They hate our foreign policy towards them for decades and decades, which kept them poor, which kept them imprisoned, and sustained those corrupt governments. They don't hate us. If anything, the Arab world, really, and the Muslim world admire the American people, admire the way American Republic has evolved, and admire our advanced technology and science and engineering. So it's really, they are in a dilemma. They are in a dilemma because they admire a lot of things from us, and they admire our own freedom. But somehow that cannot be translated, that same freedom, into the Arab world. That's all they want. They want the same rights we have, free elections.
We've been speaking with Dr. Adil Shamu. You can read his latest piece on Egypt at commondreams.org. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Dr. Adil Shamu.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
If you're watching Fox News Channel to stay up to speed on Egypt, let's hope you're not, there is one constant warning about what could come next, an Egypt ruled by the Muslim Brotherhood. We hear that the Brotherhood is tied to Al-Qaeda, or that it actually gave birth to the terrorist group. Worrying about the Muslim Brotherhood is not just confined to Fox News, though. Many pundits and news accounts contain similar language intended to suggest that a democratic Egypt could be a giant step backwards. Joining us to talk about all of this is Fawaz Gerges. He is professor of Middle Eastern politics and international relations at the London School of Economics and Political Science. He is the director of the school's Middle East Center and author of the book Journey of the Jihadist Inside Muslim Militancy. Fawaz Gerges, welcome back to Counterspin.
My pleasure.
Now, Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen wrote that under a different name, Hamas, the Muslim Brotherhood runs the Gaza Strip. A news article in USA Today referred to the Muslim Brotherhood as, quote, an early mentor to Osama bin Laden and ancestor of Hamas, whose members want a theocracy in Egypt and a return to confrontation with Israel and the West, close quote. Well, there's no doubt what signal these kinds of reports and commentary are trying to send. Are they right about the Muslim Brotherhood, though?
Well, as you will know, in the last few days in particular, as the Intifada, the revolution, the rise in social classes has gained momentum, there has been a concerted effort to use scare tactics and to warn that Egypt could go Iran way during the Islamic revolution of Iran. And the Muslim Brotherhood has been used as a kind of a justification, as a kind of a scary tactic. The reality is much more complex than that. First of all, it's the middle classes who are spearheading the Intifada, not just in Egypt, but in Tunisia and other Arab countries. You have a rainbow coalition of centrists, of Democrats, of secularists, of leftists, of nationalists, of independent Islamists, and also the Muslim Brotherhood, a very powerful religiously-based religious movement. Let me be clear about one thing. The Muslim Brotherhood has come a long way in the last 30 years. The Muslim Brotherhood renounced violence in the late 1960s. It has joined the centrist political process and has accepted the rules of the political game. In fact, I would argue that the Muslim Brotherhood has shown a great deal of maturity, a great deal of restraint. And in particular, in the last 2 or 3 years, the Muslim Brotherhood has really made some critical steps to becoming a centrist political organization. In fact, I would not compare the Muslim Brotherhood to either Hamas or Al-Qaeda. I would really compare the Muslim Brotherhood to the Turkish Islamists, that is, it seems to be traveling the same path as the Turkish Islamists and making some major strides to becoming a fully integrated centrist political movement, even though it's a religiously based movement, even though it believes that Islamic values must be critical and must be an integral part of the political process. But the Muslim Brotherhood has made it very clear. Its purpose is not to establish a religious state, and the Muslim Brotherhood would accept the consensus of the people. I think it's a force for stability. It's not a force of instability in Egypt as the momentum shifts towards the democratic forces.
I've seen some accounts that suggest that Al-Qaeda has long denounced the Muslim Brotherhood, so it's strange to see them treated as sort of brothers in arms. There has been, in some of the more sober analysis as well, you read that Mubarak has scared people about the Muslim Brotherhood as a means of keeping his grip on power in Egypt, as if to say to the United States in particular, the Muslim Brotherhood would take over if I were to leave power. So that's part of the rationale for keeping me in place.
President Hosni Mubarak has used the Muslim Brotherhood as a critical plank in his policy to scare the United States and Western powers. If you do not support me, you'll end up with a government dominated by extremists like the Muslim Brotherhood. If you don't fully give me support vis-a-vis my population, the Muslim Brotherhood, quote-unquote, an extremist organization, would basically dominate Egyptian life, will turn Egypt into another Gaza. In fact, the first few days of the Intifada in Egypt, the Egyptian government and Mubarak himself blamed the unrest, the social unrest, on the Muslim Brotherhood. Let's be clear about one point. The Muslim Brotherhood is an ideologically different Islamist organization than Al-Qaeda and other militant Islamists. In fact, one of the major books written by Ayman Zawahiri is called Bitter Harvest. And the book written by Ayman Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda's number two commander, basically Bitter Harvest, was a systemic onslaught against the Muslim Brotherhood. Ayman Zawahiri never misses an opportunity to say that the Muslim Brotherhood has sold its soul to the political process. Ayman Zawahiri accuses the Muslim Brotherhood of becoming a centrist, fully integrated Islamist movement into the political game. The reality is the Muslim Brotherhood has the Islamist movement has many faces, many manifestations, and the Muslim Brotherhood stands on one end, while Al-Qaeda stands on an extremely different end. And the reality is, I see, based on everything that I know, based on interviews I've done over the last 20 years with all the top leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, the rank and file, I see the Muslim Brotherhood traveling a similar journey to the moderate Turkish Islamists who have made a critical shift in their government's internal and external politics. Turkey today is almost a fully democratic nation, a nation at peace with itself, that is, an authentic Muslim nation and also a democracy. And I hope that the Muslim Brotherhood would reach that particular point, that is, it's an authentic Muslim and Islamist organization, while at the same time believes in universal values and human rights and what we call an institutional democratic entity. It's not yet there. There are multiple constituencies within the Muslim Brotherhood, but I believe it has traveled a long way and still has a long way to go.
And finally, there has been some criticism of the way the Brotherhood has managed itself. You've written some, and some of this criticism, as have others, that the leadership is out of touch with the Egyptian population. There is a reformist wing that has been sort of tamped down over the last couple of years. It makes it sound like, far from being in a position to sort of dominate future Egyptian government or politics, they'd more likely play a smaller role than that. Is that the way you see things playing out potentially?
Yes. I mean, let's be clear. If you have free elections in Egypt tomorrow, the Muslim Brotherhood basically would garner between 20 and 25% of the vote. 20 and 25% of the vote. That's a very critical constituency, but that's not a majority. When I say a rainbow coalition of oppositional forces in Egypt, I'm talking about really a broadly based oppositional forces dominated by centrist forces. And I like to believe that the Muslim Brotherhood will be an integral part of this particular opposition. Today, the Vice President of Egypt, Omar Suleiman, said the government has basically would like to engage the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood has agreed to engage with the Egyptian government. This is a titanic shift on the part of the Egyptian government. The only way to go is to engage all political forces, secular, liberal, Democrat, centrist, and Islamist. This is the only way to build a democratic coalition, to build a transnational unity government that takes Egypt away from dictatorship to institutional building and pluralistic government. This is the way to go. But to use scare tactics in order to say we must support Mubarak is basically a very counterproductive policy. Not only it harms the interests of the democratic voices throughout the Arab world, it harms American and Western interests in the short term and the long term as well.
Fawaz Jerjes is a professor at the London School of Economics and Political Science. He directs the Middle East Center there. His most recent book is Journey of the Jihadists Inside Muslim Militancy. Fawaz Jerjes, thanks again for joining us here on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. Again, that's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. You can also listen to Counterspin at FAIR's website at fair.org. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.